May it please the court. Each decade seems to bring to this country another crisis. We're in the subprime mortgage crisis now. In the past, we had savings and loan, the Enron collapse, and so forth. This case arises from a crisis that began in the gas industry back in the 80s, as the industry transition from a time of price controls and supply shortages to an era of decontrol, a rebounding supply source. And what that brought to bear was pipelines were left with what is referred to as high-priced take-or-pay contracts. And there was a great concern at FERC and elsewhere on what was to be done with this, because there was concern of bankruptcies and other economic dislocations. I think at least one pipeline, in fact, did go through bankruptcy. That was Columbia. And what FERC did to respond to that is to undertake a bundle of carrots and sticks and, I guess, general bully pulpit exhortations to the industry to try to settle these problems. And in fact, they did. As FERC states in their order 500H that I cite in my brief, their efforts was a resounding success. These dislocations were mitigated. The bankruptcies that were feared did not happen. And I think that one additional thing that the commission found was that it was noteworthy that the producers, in the words of, again, 500H, gave real and substantial concessions in these settlements to give up take-or-pay obligations, to lower their prices for forward-going, to bring them down to market levels, to let the pipelines off the hook for continuing take obligations. And the commission conceded that that's producers gave up these substantial benefits. And it also noted, and I quote this in my brief, that the fact is when producers took the pipelines to court over these take-or-pay contracts, they invariably won. So this wasn't just an empty concession. These were substantial concessions that gave real benefits to the pipelines and to consumers. It's in this context that this case arose, because the settlements that we seek here for FERC to enforce, and we are challenging their failure to enforce, were in fact two settlements, the 1981 Northern settlement and the 1992 Panhandle settlement, that were entered into in this era. And that Burlington gave,
if I understand it correctly, these are bracketed by a decision of this court in 1988 throwing into question FERC's classification of the Kansas tax. And FERC's decision in 93, I think, we got it wrong, the Kansas tax is to be borne by the producer, right?
That is correct. In 80, I think you have the years correct.
Throughout the period of negotiations, the status of the Kansas tax was very much in flux.
The status of the Kansas tax was in flux, but what we didn't have was a potential claim. What we still hadn't had was FERC had not acted until, as you say, 1993 to declare that the Kansas tax was in fact not properly recovered under Section 110 of the NGPA. So what you really have here are claims that were potential unliquidated claims. And that's why the provision that this court found in the last time this case was before the court that obligated the pipelines to bear this obligation arose under the clause that the commission has acknowledged in the orders on review as typical for these gas contract settlements and buyout provisions is a provision to indemnify and release parties from the unknown, from the potential, from the unliquidated claims. And it's very understandable that these provisions, as FERC said, were usual. And that is when you're in the process of taking gas contracts and reforming them, terminating them in many cases, certainly from the producer's standpoint, it's eminently reasonable for them to say, look, we're going to give you 90, as in the case of Burlington, 90 cents on the dollar for our take-or-pay claims. We're going to let you off the hook and terminate these high-priced contracts. We're going to make all these concessions. We're not going to continue to amass additional take-or-pay obligations. But in return, please just don't come back 5 years later and make a claim for a couple of hundred thousand dollars, which is exactly what we're talking about here. If you look at the principal amount that these claims were, in both instances were several hundred thousand dollars. And that is why that FERC takes these settlements, which they actively encouraged, and now say that they can't enforce them because, and even if they contain these release and indemnity provisions that FERC certainly said were typical and usual and there was nothing wrong with them, but they're saying that these contracts are unenforceable under Southern Union because Burlington failed to identify the specific consideration that they gave to the pipeline specifically for that one element of the bundle of consideration that's passing between the parties for this ad valorem taxes. I would submit, Your Honor, that that's just a test that's impossible to meet when you're in the realm of potential and unliquidated claims. It was not known what FERC was going to do, and particularly it was certainly not known what ultimately was going to be decided by the court in 1996 in the Public Service Commission case when the court decided that there would be a substantial retroactivity element to the finding of the Kansas ad valorem tax.
In some parts of your brief, you speak of the question whether a producer could collect more than the NGPA price for gas. But I guess as I see the settlement, that is not exactly the question. The question is whether, under conditions of uncertainty, producer and pipeline can work out a deal which, looked at later when the uncertainty about the Kansas tax, for example, is resolved in favor of the pipeline, produces a price which, if it had been agreed on under full understanding of what the rule was, would have been in excess of the NGPA price, which strikes me as a completely different proposition.
I think you've accurately characterized, I think, the situation is that there was not known, and it was only known later on exactly how much that amount was. So at the time of the settlement, it was a good faith effort by the parties to bring these contracts to a close with the understanding that no one in years down the road was going to come back after the other based on a claim. And that claim was unknown. There may have been other unknown claims at the time that the record doesn't disclose and that I'm not aware of, but that parties are not allowed to sue each other under these agreements because we've already settled. What FERC is essentially saying here is, thank you very much, Burlington, for settling and helping us out of this pickle of the gas contract crisis, but we want you to settle a second time. And we don't think anything in Southern Union would suggest that that is required or that FERC is precluded from acknowledging and giving effect to a reasonable good faith settlement, particularly in the area when these claims are unliquidated, and to give effect to them, particularly given the fact that FERC was hardly an innocent bystander in encouraging these agreements to be entered into. But even if FERC is correct in saying that Southern Union is determinative on the point of whether these were lawful in the first instance. And I think that the Southern Union case deals with a state court judgment in a case that arose from a claim on intrastate gas contracts. And it had nothing to do with take or pay settlements or the reasonableness of a good faith settlement of an interstate gas contracts where the interstate market was getting benefits in return for these indemnity and release provisions. Southern Union raises none of those elements before it. But even if that's where we are, the commission acknowledges that they have discretion. They exercise that discretion in the omnibus settlements, that they can nonetheless approve a settlement where they find that it's reasonable in exercise of prosecutorial discretion. And then they have a second ability under the discretion under the adjustment provision, specifically that even if there's a finding that there was, if you look at these settlements and you just isolate the ad valorem tax and you forget all about the other exchanges of consideration and you say, no, sorry, the ad valorem taxes, you violated the ceiling prices, then there's still the ability to give an equitable adjustment. And in this instance, we submit that if ever there was a case of inequity, here is a settlement that was entered into at the behest of the commission, and Burlington does so. All the consideration that Burlington offered in the relief that they gave to the pipeline was passed through to the customers.
On this issue, on whether it's equitable to distinguish between the two, why isn't it equitable to distinguish between agreements like the omnibus ones that specifically state they are to resolve the tax issues and explain what the rationale and what the discounting is, versus one which the FERC, I think, accurately described as boilerplate, and from the way you're describing it, it was boilerplate too. It was to talk about claims that people really weren't focused on, were only potential, and was basically to shut down further claims that people weren't really sure about at the time. Why isn't a distinction between one which specifically deals with the tax issue and one which doesn't mention it at all? Why is that arbitrary?
I think there is several reasons, Your Honor. First is, as I said, that this release and indemnification provision, in a sense, boilerplate. These are very short contracts. They're in the record. They're only a few pages, and it's certainly
boilerplate
not
boilerplate in the sense that it mentions other things that are other kinds of consideration, but doesn't mention tax at all.
That's right. It's the only thing the parties can do when there is no liquidated claim.
Bear in mind the issue that Judge Garland is asking you about. You're asking us to rule that FERC has violated an equitable duty in an arbitrary and capricious fashion by not treating this the same as an agreement that has quite a few distinctions. You think it's consistent with our usual standard of review on that issue to come in and tell us, well, parties couldn't have entered a different contract here? Is that enough to get you over that hump?
I think it is, and I think that there are two separate standards here. One is that under their prosecutorial discretion, on the one hand, they approved the omnibus agreements, and on the other hand, they didn't approve it here.
Well, the omnibus was submitted to them for approval, right?
It was submitted to them for...
And yours was not, right?
No, because there was no vehicle for the...
Yeah, I'm not asking you about a because. I'm just asking you about the differences between these...
That is a difference, but I don't think it's a reasonable basis for FERC to approve the one and not the other. Because in this instance, at the time these agreements were entered into, the only mechanism for FERC approval was in fact when FERC approved the pass-through of the benefits of those.
What is our standard of review on this issue?
Arbitrary and capricious and abuse of discretion, I think. Mm-hmm. And in the arbitrary and capricious, as the court in the first opinion suggested, that there was that FERC had not explained why the omnibus agreements were worthy of approval and not here. And the omnibus agreements we point out that there was no consideration given by the producers to get, in some instances, complete exoneration, and others about a 25% reduction, whereas in our case, if anything, it's more favorable insofar as that we gave substantial consideration for the forgiveness that we got. I think the other distinctions that FERC tries to draw is that, well, they say that the pipelines and the commission never consented to these agreements, and I think that intertwined with that is the notion that, in their view, there should be no effort to coerce the pipeline into an agreement that they didn't consent to. But that, to me, is a classic bootstrap for the pipeline. This court's already found that they agreed to to bear the ad valorem tax.
Okay, our time limit is up. Unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll hear from the respondent. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Judith Albert for the Commission. The court remanded the first set of orders in this proceeding so that the Commission could more adequately explain 2 points, and we submit that the Commission satisfied that mandate in the orders challenged here. First, I think I will address the matter of consideration because petitioner did so quite extensively. The Commission's viewpoint on consideration in this case is that Burlington emphasizes the idea that it gave considerable consideration for the pipelines agreeing to make refunds on the ad valorem taxes. In fact, that's a little bit of a distortion of the consideration. These take-and-pay agreements were made in a particular time frame to solve a particular problem. That was, as has been explained by petitioner, the significant problems that the take-or-pay agreements were creating for the energy industry. In exchange for modifying the take-or-pay settlements, Burlington received considerable consideration. This included payments by the pipelines at the time of the settlements. It included the fact that Burlington retained, of course, all of the gas that the pipelines are no longer required to take. Burlington, of course.
What you seem to be saying is that a lot was involved.
A lot was involved.
I don't think anyone disputes that. But then you say, we don't say, but the Commission said in the order on the hearing, paragraph 52, it recites how transaction like this you can't pinpoint any particular payment for any particular purpose, right?
That's correct.
That's what you said. And then you say, thus, in a case like this, the primary focus is also on factual disputes, which is unwilling to treat any portion of the consideration as constituting a refund of the pipeline's actual payment for gas in excess of the NGA ceiling price. But what you really seem to be saying is that since a whole bunch of claims going both ways, we will allocate, we the Commission, will allocate certain amounts to simply the price of gas, even though at the time the agreements were entered into, the full permissible price of the gas was unknown. Have I misstated that?
What the Commission said was that the take-or-pay agreements were about selling the take-or-pay problem. The Commission said in paragraph...
That was one issue that was involved in these two settlements. Right?
The take-or-pay problem was the issue to be settled in the 1989 and 1992 take-or-pay settlements.
I think that reading contradicts our interpretation of the contract. In our earlier decision, our interpretation of the contract was that it was for the whole anything that was in dispute.
All claims and liabilities relating to Kansas gas sale contract under the, at the time of the 89-7.
I think
we accepted Burlington's reading.
For the purposes of the challenge orders, commission accepted the idea that the indemnity clauses could apply to the ad valorem taxes.
Right,
yes, but as the commission said in, at JA, I think it's in the rehearing order at paragraph 49, the commission explained that in order for Burlington to have demonstrated that it fulfilled its refund obligations for the ad valorem taxes through the mechanism of the take-or-pay settlement, Burlington would have had to indicate in the take-or-pay settlements that, for example, the commission, the pipelines would agree to pay a sum certain to Burlington, and a sum of money would be subtracted from that to account for the ad valorem obligation on the part of Burlington. Again, this is in paragraph 49.
I mean, what's the basis for that? That's what I don't understand.
Because the basis for that is the basis for that goes. The basis for that is that under Section 504 of the Natural Gas Policy Act, the seller is not allowed to keep any amount of money above the maximum lawful price.
But you've assumed that that certain amounts have to be attributed to the gas, right?
Well, what the commission, first of all, did not assume that certain amounts in the take-or-pay settlement had anything to do with past prices for the gas. The commission made that, based that on that 1985 take-or-pay settlement. The 1989 and 1992 take-or-pay settlements were prospective in nature in the sense that they were resolving the question of the taking of gas in the future.
Pricing issues under a set of contracts.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Issues. All issues under a set of contracts.
But the commission.
Those issues, given the legal conditions prevailing in the ADA of 93, included the Kansas tax. Are you denying that?
And at the time that the 1989 and 1992 take-or-pay settlements were entered into, at that point in time, the ad valorem tax was considered to be a severance tax that could be collected above and beyond the.
It had just been reversed by this court.
Yes,
right?
But
it had been was under an obligation to go back and look at it.
The commission was required by that decision to go back and re-examine it. That was not the same thing as saying that the commission would not come to the same conclusion. Of course, the commission didn't.
But you aren't denying that it created uncertainty.
No, I'm not denying that at all.
So is the commission's argument really that parties cannot work out a settlement of past prices when past transactions where some element of those is in dispute in terms of the NGPA? Of course, this soon will be completely obsolete, I hope. In any event, they can't work out a settlement which, in hindsight, it turns out, involves the pipeline paying more than what would have been due if, at the time of the settlement, all the parties had known exactly what FERC and the courts would rule. That's a very extreme position, I think.
The commission's
very
position. The commission's position rests on the decision in Southern Union. As the commission interpreted.
In Southern Union, the court explicitly says that the payments were for the price of gas, and it isn't a settlement. It arose out of a settlement. But what you're talking about is state court litigation, an award of damages.
But the Southern Union case, I respectfully submit, says that the point is to look at the effect of what takes place. In Southern Union, the effect of the damages was to give Consolidated money in addition to the lawful maximum price.
The question is, how do you know what the effect is when there's uncertainty at the time of the settlement?
That again goes back to the commission's premise, particularly on the waiver side, that in fact the take-or-pay settlements were not about ad valorem. And if
I want to call your attention to some language in the release and indemnity clause. Now, I understand this is boilerplate, but that doesn't mean it's invalid on its face, that each party completely, fully, and completely and finally releases and discharges the other, their respective affiliates, ellipses, from any and all liabilities, claims, and causes of action, whether at law or in equity, and whether known or whether now known and asserted or hereinafter discovered, arising out of or in conjunction with or relating to said contracts for all periods through January 31, 1989. Now, is the Commission saying that settlements that have that kind of full release of unknown claims do not affect things that are asserted later? Or is it saying that this is, in this particular contract, you're not going to recognize?
What the Commission is saying is that, in the context of the ad valorem taxes, that enforcement of that indemnity clause so as to require the pipelines to pay more than the lawful price by having to pay the ad valorem taxes, that constitutes an unlawful agreement that the Commission is declining to enforce.
That assumes the conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Again, that's why
because it assumes that a payment made under conditions of uncertainty can be reevaluated later, and a provision completely undone because of the relationship between what we later know and a legal rule.
Well, the legal rule, as far as ad valorem taxes are concerned, is that collection by the producer of the ad valorem taxes of
we understand that. Mm-hmm. We understand the rule which was arrived at in 1993 pushing the commission to further refund obligation. We understand that, but what we're talking about is what effect is given to settlements made under conditions of uncertainty versus what generates settlements.
Mm-hmm. Could I press on this just a little bit further? Isn't your view not only that FERC's view, not only that the boilerplate settlement is illegal, but that even the omnibus settlement was illegal?
Mm-hmm. That statement was in the brief. It's probably a little bit inartfully stated.
Looking at paragraph 30 of the order on remand, I'm just asking whether that, I don't obviously care what the brief says, I care what the commission says. Is the commission's view that, it's a little unclear. It says the commission believes that all such agreements are unlawful and unenforceable. And then acts as if it's applying prosecutorial discretion to the omnibus. Mm-hmm. Have I overinterpreted it?
No. What the Commission's position with regard to the omnibus ad valorem settlements is that probably to some extent some producers kept monies that they should not have kept pursuant to the NGPA. However, the Commission in those settlements was exercising its limited prosecutorial discretion to do nothing.
Let me just focus on the first part for some minutes. So I actually do see a distinction, at least for equitable purposes, between an agreement that doesn't mention taxes at all and one that does. But this gives me some concern that even with one that expressly says we are trading the tax liability for the other consideration that's being provided here, so that the people who the companies that would otherwise be entitled to a refund say, you know, in their mind, that refund is worth $100,000, but we're going to give that up in exchange for $100,000 of other goodies. Are you saying that that is also unlawful? Is the commission saying that that would also be unlawful? You can't trade your right to a refund of $100,000 for $100,000 of some other kind of consideration.
As I understand your question, you're talking about the consideration that the pipelines and Burlington swapped in the settlements.
In the omnibus settlements. I'm talking about the omnibus settlements for a minute, the ones that discuss the tax specifically.
In the omnibus settlements, the Commission did not address any of the litigated issues on the merits. The Commission simply accepted the omnibus settlements.
I'm back to this question in paragraph 30. It sounds like the commission is saying that the omnibus settlements were also illegal, and I thought you just said that you thought to some extent they were.
Yeah. If in fact the issues had been litigated in all of those claims that were settled by the omnibus ad valorem settlements,
if they were later litigated.
If there had been no settlement, if there had been no omnibus ad valorem settlement, and the issues had been litigated, then
there's no way to figure that out.
There's no way to figure that out, right?
Imagine. Let me go through two hypotheticals. Okay. The first hypothetical is, you owe us $100,000 in refunds for wrongly collected taxes, and we owe you $100,000 for something else, and we're going to call it even. Now, is that an illegal agreement?
Yes.
Even if it's a complete swap of $100,000.
If you have $100,000 and you have it unlawfully, and I give you consideration
worth $100,000,
at the end you still have something unlawfully.
Let's go back one further hypothetical then, so I get this even straighter. So you took from me $100,000 unlawfully, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I owe you $100,000 for work that you did for me,
mm-hmm.
okay? And we agree to call that even. Now, is that agreement unlawful?
No.
It's not, because if we enforce the agreement, I would give you $100,000 and you would give me $100,000, and it would be exactly the same as if
right.
we just walked away mm-hmm. and we'd save the transaction cost, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So that's hypothetical one. Hypothetical two is, I know you unlawfully took some amount of tax from me. I don't know exactly how much of that is unlawful and how much it isn't, because there's a lot of complicated calculations. And I'm willing to take $80,000 from you. I'm willing to take $80,000 for the work. You're willing to take $80,000 for your work, and I'm willing to accept that in exchange for the uncertainty of whether I will ever collect the $100,000. Is that unlawful? I'm being clear enough about that.
Yeah, you're being clear enough about that. If those facts had been litigated and had been determined exactly how much money I kept unlawfully, then the commission would have had an obligation, assuming it was a commission case, to enforce.
You're talking about determined, litigated after the event.
Yes.
Right. So what I'm asking then would be the third hypothetical, but it's really the same as the other one, which is, the reason I'm uncertain about how much I get back is the only way I'm going to get it back is to litigate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the chances are. And I've, you know, consulted my lawyers, and I believe I'm going to get, you know, after the whole fight, I have a X percent chance of getting $100,000, but a much bigger chance of getting $80,000. And I think, given the transaction costs and litigation costs and everything else, that I'm going to settle for $80,000, because that's a discounted value of what I might get if I litigate it. But this is not going to be litigated, because I'm going to settle. Is it unlawful to decide at that moment that we're never going to litigate this, that I'm going to settle for $80,000 because I think that's the discounted value of my claim? Is that unlawful?
It doesn't sound unlawful, no.
But isn't that what FERC's saying about the settlement agreements here, that they're unlawful for that reason?
No, what FERC...
The omnibus settlement agreements, I'm sorry.
The omnibus ad valorem settlements?
Yes.
What FERC is saying about the omnibus ad valorem settlements is that if they had been litigated, it was possible that on the merits, after litigation, some producers would have kept unlawful amounts of money.
So is their view that the omnibus settlement agreements were unlawful at the time at which they were entered into?
No.
That seemed to be what they said.
That's what I thought. So they're,
yeah. So
you're saying the FERC is not saying that they were unlawful at that moment.
I would refer the court to.
I'm looking at paragraph 30. I'm not saying it's clear. That's what I'm asking you about.
Actually the paragraph that I would refer you to.
Okay, so we're both referring to the same.
You got a JA reference on the one you're referring
yes,
to.
Yes, 401.
Okay, thank you.
Do I have that?
Yeah.
The commission says that as a result of the omnibus settlement, some producers end up retaining amounts in excess of the maximum lawful price is not the equivalent of recognizing that Section 504 does not render all private agreements allowing retention of the excess unlawful.
Right, and then the next sentence, as discussed above, as the court held in Southern Union, the commission believes that all such agreements are unlawful and unenforceable. All that the omnibus settlements bring about is a termination of commission enforcement actions. I guess one way to interpret it, that is to say that the omnibus settlements are also illegal, just like the Burlington settlement, but we're not going to enforce.
Yeah, unless paragraph 26 is meaningless, isn't that what paragraph 26 is saying, where you bring in the rubric of prosecutorial discretion?
Heckler v. Cheney, yes.
Heckler v. Cheney.
So in order to uphold this opinion, would we have to agree not only that a boilerplate agreement that doesn't mention taxes is unlawful, but also that even an agreement that quite specifically trades consideration for consideration over taxes is also unlawful, because that's underlying what's going on here.
Actually, I don't think the commission would say that that necessarily follows, because really whether the omnibus ad valorem settlement was lawful or unlawful, it doesn't change the fact that the commission's distinction here is that it chose not to do any enforcement action in the omnibus ad valorem settlements.
That causes me to raise the question of whether prosecutorial discretion is really the appropriate rubric for approaching this case at all. FERC is not just a prosecutor, it's also an adjudicator and a regulator. And there you have not the essentially unbounded discretion of the prosecutor who decides whether to prosecute interstate auto theft or send it back to the states, but you have an adjudicator whose duty it is not to arbitrarily and capriciously treat parties differently. So I question whether this is within the appropriate rubric for prosecutorial discretion. Even in Heckler v. Cheney, which pretty well takes it to the extreme, they were dealing there not with a choice by the secretary to choose to enforce certain regulations against some entities but not against others. That was whether to regulate the area of the lethal drugs at all. We have limited resources. We're not going to regulate in that area because we have other things to do that have more impact. Here you're talking about how you chose to treat two parties who at least the petitioner asserts are similarly situated, and you're going to have to meet an arbitrary and capricious standard, not hide behind prosecutorial discretion. Am I wrong about that, or is this a prosecutorial decision?
I think that's correct, but the commission's orders, I submit, go to great length to make the distinction between the two cases.
That's a different question. That's a different question to assert that the distinction made is not arbitrary and capricious. But it doesn't get you past the arbitrary and capricious standard and get you over under prosecutorial discretion. I think you're going to write arbitrary and capricious standard out of the law if you start allowing the commission to distinguish between regulated entities and say they did so on the basis of prosecutorial discretion. Maybe there's a distinction here that keeps it from being arbitrary and capricious, but I question whether the rubric of prosecutorial discretion applies at all.
On just that point, I hadn't thought about this before. So a court couldn't say, we've decided not to, two parties come in with two different settlements, and the court couldn't say, we're going to, we think they're both unlawful, but we're only going to enforce one. The court couldn't do that. And Judge Santel is asking, isn't FERC doing that not in the context of an enforcer who brings an action, but as a adjudicator who in the end decides in an adjudication whether or not a contract should be enforced or not?
The distinction based on Heckler v. Cheney. Under Heckler v. Cheney, the commission can, in a limited fashion, have prosecutorial discretion to withhold action. And that's what the commission did in the omnibus.
That had to do with whether to regulate in a particular area at all or not. That was not an adjudication in Heckler v. Cheney. The application was made that you should come over here and stop this execution because you haven't regulated lethal drugs. They didn't say you regulated lethal drugs in Kansas but not Oregon, so therefore you should stop it. This was They were, whether or not to act as a prosecutor was the question in Heckler v. Cheney. This is an adjudication. This is not a prosecution decision, is it?
Well, I would also point the court to the D.C. Circuit case in Baltimore Gas that's cited at footnote 16 at JA 399, in which Heckler v. Cheney was applied in a FERC situation.
Can we just go back to the commission to your classification of the omnibus settlements as illegal? I take it the principle then has to be that whenever two parties where the sale between them is subject to a regulated price, whenever they work out a settlement with respect to past transactions, and there's some issue which has not yet been resolved by the commission and by the courts, whenever it turns out, maybe years after the settlement, that it would have come out differently. It would have come out with a lower implicit price for the gas or electricity that was agreed on in the settlement. The only thing that enables a party to insist on enforcement of the settlement is prosecutorial discretion. It's all entirely the more or less the whim of FERC, whether that such settlement gets enforced.
Well,
I mean, the question obviously isn't your doctrine just driving a complete hole in partners' willingness to settle?
I will point out that this case is considering the National Gas Policy Act, Section 504, which limited.
You're still deciding just and reasonable rates. There's still a lot that's regulated.
There's still a lot that's regulated, but Section 504 took away a lot of FERC's activity in this area. Section 504
is set. It's a different way of setting the ceiling price, but ceiling prices are still being determined.
I would respectfully disagree in the sense that 504 does not give the Commission any authority to adjust the ceiling price. The seller is simply barred from collecting more than the maximum lawful price.
You aren't saying, aren't you, or you aren't saying, are you, that if you have if two parallel transactions, A, B deal and C, D deal, A and D work out settlement, and everything is otherwise but A and B work out settlement for a price that gas or electricity will be essentially resolved as if the just and reasonable price were $10. And then in the CD don't settle. So it's taken through FERC and endless litigation ensues. The FERC final judgment there is $11. At that point, the AB settlement must be unraveled. The question of whether the AB settlement will be unraveled is entirely a matter of FERC's discretion. So A and B may have been totally wasting their time.
I'm sorry, I'm losing myself on the A's and the B's.
They're identical sales, except that in the AB transaction, while things are confused, there's a settlement. And in the CD deal, there's no settlement, right? So it's litigated, and we find out ultimately from FERC, confirmed on appeal, that the price, the just and reasonable price, was $11. Okay? So now, it's entirely a question of FERC's prosecutorial discretion, but it goes back and unravels the $10 deal between A and B. Is that right?
I don't think so. If the A deal is over and done with, it's settled. There's no reason for FERC to go back. I don't think FERC could go back if it's.
Sorry, that sounds like this case. done deal as we interpreted the contract.
In this case, what we get back again to the question of consideration. FERC did not consider that there was any indication in the indemnity clauses that there was...
That turns on FERC's notion that there isn't consideration unless the settlement designates X is for Y, A is for B, C is for D, and so forth, which doesn't sound like an ordinary settlement. It sounds like some completely difficult structure.
But in this case, FERC's concern was that under the NGPA, Burlington is not, as a producer, is not permitted to keep more than the maximum lawful price. And to the extent...
...away from the case is to the ordinary character of settlements, and B, the uncertainty under which the parties were acting.
And the uncertainty, I would submit, gets back to the fact that these take-or-pay settlements were about resolving the take-or-pay contracts prospectively.
They included the language which Judge Santel read and which we read in the earlier Burlington case as meaning what it said.
But under, again, FERC, as FERC indicating in the orders, FERC's view was that under Southern Union, FERC had to be very careful about ensuring that the effect of its taking an active enforcement role here, and again, that's FERC would be taking an active enforcement role to make the pipelines pay more than the maximum lawful price.
Did this begin as an enforcement proceeding procedurally? How did this?
No.
Right.
No.
Baltimore Gas, where we did use the term prosecutorial discretion with reference to the discretion of FERC as being prosecutorial as opposed to the arbitrary and capricious standard, that was an enforcement proceeding, right? And in that instance, a third party was objecting to FERC's having settled an enforcement proceeding. Now, here you talk about enforcing. You're not being asked to conduct an enforcement proceeding. You're just being asked to give effect to the settlement agreement the parties have made. And it's raised defensively, essentially, here, isn't it?
But under Heckler v. Cheney, speaks about an agency's ability or a prosecutor's ability to withhold an enforcement action.
Well, that doesn't mean that an adjudicatory agency can act differently with reference to one entity than it does with reference to another. That may be the case that you have grounds for the differentiation that rise above the arbitrary and capricious standard, but that's not the same thing as relying on prosecutorial discretion to get out of the normal kind of review that we make. Heckler v. Cheney had to do with whether they were going to regulate in a particular area at all, didn't it?
But to get back to the court's decision remanding the prior set of orders, mm-hmm. One of the points that the court wanted the commission to address was why was it okay if the omnibus ad valorem settlements resulted in some producers keeping too much money? What was the difference between the commission's actions there and the commission's actions in saying that it could not enforce the
And what we're trying to find out now is whether you've come up with an adequate or whether the commission has come up with an adequate answer to that question. And I question whether relying on prosecutorial discretion addresses the same question. This is not a prosecution. In Baltimore Gas and Electric, it was. It was enforcement action, which is like a prosecution.
But the fact of the matter is that the omnibus ad valorem settlements took place in the context of not FERC saying that it's fine for producers to keep the money. They took place in the context of FERC essentially saying, we are accepting this settlement.
You approved the settlement, right? You approved the settlement, right?
The commission approved the settlement, which is the same thing, in essence.
How is that different than enforcing the settlement when it's asserted defensively in litigation like this?
Because in accepting the ad valorem settlements, The commission was saying simply, there's however many there were, 1,500 claims, whatever, we're not going to do anything about it. You folks are happy, that's fine. We're not forcing anybody to do anything. We're not litigating any issues on the merits. In the case of Burlington's request that the commission enforce the indemnity clauses, the commission's position is that would mean that the commission would not just be taking a hands-off, the commission would be enforcing a private agreement that would require the pipelines as the purchasers to pay more than the maximum lawful price under the NGPA. And that gets us, of course, back to the question of consideration, and addressed that earlier.
Turns entirely upon the notion that the settlement to be effective with respect to any particular issue, consideration with respect to that issue has to be pinpointed. I mean, the commission follows Williams Natural Gas, which does take such a view in a completely different context. The question is whether the deal between the producer and the pipeline, how that's to be treated vis-a-vis the pipeline's customers.
I would submit that maybe the word pinpointed might be a little more than FERC would have required. There should have been something in the contracts indicating that Burlington was going to be giving up enough so that it could not be said to have kept any of the unlawful amounts of money. As I pointed out in JA 46, paragraph 49, the commission gave an example of one way that the take-or-pay settlements could have been constructed to take care of the ad valorem situation. If in fact there had been some indefinite statement about, well, if in the future the ad valorem case develops so that Burlington owes more money, Burlington will either have to pay or it's receiving less consideration because of it.
A general clause wrapping up all claims will not be enforced, or at least will only be enforced in the commission's very broad prosecutorial discretion.
Again, the commission has characterized its prosecutorial discretion here as being very limited. It can withhold action as a part of prosecutorial discretion, but it doesn't have the discretion to go forward in a case like this, where in the commission's view, enforcement would.
On the contract before it. I don't really understand prosecutorial discretion.
Does it have the discretion with respect to those omnibus settlements to not enforce those either? I appreciate it decided not to do that in this case, but if it had gone the other way, would it have had that discretion?
If what had gone the other way?
Could forget about that part. Could FERC have gone the other way? Could FERC have said, we're not going to enforce, these settlement, omnibus settlements are also unlawful and we're not going to enforce them either? Could it have said that as a matter of prosecutorial discretion?
If the commission had not wanted to approve the omnibus ad valorem settlements, it simply would have gone ahead and litigated all of the issues. That was a procedural status.
Imagine that they had been agreed to, and then one of the parties wanted out after further decisions of this court made clearer how much money they were going to get. Could at that point FERC have said, we're going to let you out of the settlement? As a matter of prosecutorial discretion, we're not going to enforce the settlement.
Well, there's a number of ways that could proceed, but my guess would be that the commission would treat that party the same way as it treated Burlington, which says, okay, you're not part of the settlement any longer. Let's go to litigation and see what happens.
Okay, so it could have done the same. So it's not just the problem that Judge Williams was pinpointing out of pinpointing. It's any agreement that, with respect to ad valorem taxes, the commission could decide not to enforce because it's unlawful, in FERC's view. Is that right?
The omnibus The omnibus ad valorem settlements, the commission took no action. Now, I'm not sure the import of your question, but if some party...
It seems like a timing question. So Burlington entered into an agreement. At the time, everybody was happy. Then there were more cases. Now one party's not happy. I'm not saying with no judgment about whether people should be happy or not. In the omnibus case, they entered into an agreement with more information.
This time of year.
But imagine they got even more information later, and now one party's not happy anymore. I'm just asking whether the original settlement in either case was legal. Now, you said the original case in the Burlington, the initial settlement in Burlington, obviously the initial settlement in Burlington was perfectly lawful had there been no further developments with respect to ad valorem taxes, right?
Yes.
So you are asking to look after there are new developments. And that could apply to the
take or pay settlements were perfectly lawful, and the indemnity clauses, too, are perfectly lawful. What the commission found is that Burlington is asking it to enforce those indemnity clauses in a particular way, and it's that particular way of enforcing them that the commission has found to be unlawful, and that's why the commission chose not to enforce them in this particular case. Now, again, in terms of the original the omnibus ad valorem settlement, again, if one of the parties later decided to opt out, and if it's not too late to opt out, then that party's case would be litigated the same as the Burlington case here.
Okay. Well, we've kept you on your feet a great deal longer than your allocated time. I doubt if you'll mind if I cut you off now, unless my colleagues have further questions. We'll hear from the intervener.
One question.
Excuse me?
In ruling on the omnibus settlements, did the commission find them illegal and then exercise prosecutorial discretion?
No, the commission found that they were fair and in the public interest, and providing a lot of benefits to both sides.
So this is a rewriting of history.
I submit that it's not a rewriting of history, Your Honor. I think
sounds
that
I know the outcome comes out the same. Settlements get
but the action that the commission took accepting the ad valorem settlements was the same thing as FERC saying we're not going to pursue the litigation on these anymore.
You just said they found them fair and equitable.
The commission found that the settlement was fair by finding that the
and enforcing an unlawful price.
What the commission chose by accepting the omnibus settlement, what the commission was doing was refraining from having to decide on the merits any of the individual claims. The commission never reached a point of deciding whether, in fact, any of those individual claims were unlawful. And that's the essence of prosecutorial discretion. The entity decides not to pursue
not
a possible violation of the statute.
No, it isn't. No,
it's not prosecutorial at all. You didn't decide whether to go out and find this right and enforce it. You decided that the commission did how to pass on the adjudication of the fairness and justice and public interest of the settlement. I'm just not sure how you think that fits the rubric of prosecution.
But the commission did not make
any... If we call this kind of thing prosecutorial discretion, I think we've done away with the arbitrary and capricious standard. You may defeat the arbitrary and capricious standard, but I don't see how you can do it by prosecutorial discretion. None of the cases you've cited to us involve an adjudication or a pair of adjudications in which there's a need to distinguish the adjudications and an adjudicatory body saying, well, we used our prosecutorial discretion to rule differently in the two cases. You may win on arbitrary and capricious, but I don't think you can get out from under that standard.
Well, in fact, we did cite arbitrary and capricious in our standard of review, and we do think that the commission has made a case that there is a sufficient distinction between his treatment of the omnibus.
Right, that's two different things. Yeah. There may be a sufficient distinction to get over the arbitrary and capricious hurdle. But that's a different thing than saying this is prosecutorial discretion. Your Baltimore gas case involved an enforcement action by the commission. not an adjudication of rights between parties. Somebody else was asserting the commission shouldn't have settled its enforcement action. Third party. And the commission said, look, it's our action, we can settle it. And it, we approved them. That's not the same thing that happened here. Oh, excuse me, once again, we've come way past your lights, and I seriously doubt if you'll mind us calling you to a close.
Okay, thank you very much.
Once again, we'll call on the respondent. Unless my colleagues
have further questions.
Intervener, I'm sorry. Thank you, Judge Williams. I got him the first time, but I'd forgotten by now.
May it please the court. My name is Frank Kelly. I'm appearing on behalf of Northern Natural Gas Company and Panhandle Eastern Pipeline Company. The omnibus settlements were vastly different from the Burlington settlements. They resulted in $45 million worth of refunds to Northern's customers, $40 million worth of refunds to Panhandle's customers. They were agreed to by all segments of the industry, producers, pipelines, customers, state utility commissions, and ultimately approved by the commission as in the public interest. It avoided years of protracted litigation in determining the individual Kansas ad valorem liability of each.
Do you understand FERC still is saying that they're illegal, but we're going to withhold?
They're not saying that at all, Your Honor.
What do you think they say in that paragraph?
What they're saying, they're referring to the private agreements. This case was remanded to determine if the commission's ruling in the first set of orders that all private agreements that violate Section 504 of the NGPA are illegal and unenforceable, and the commission reaffirmed that finding.
Look at paragraph 30, JA-401.
That's what I'm looking at.
So that starts with that as a result of the omnibus settlements, that's your settlement, that's the settlement
exactly
we're talking about, right?
Is not the equivalent.
It's not the equivalent of this commission saying that Section 504 does not render unlawful all private agreement. The commission believes that all such agreements are unlawful and unenforceable.
All such agreements, the private agreements. The omnibus settlement isn't a private agreement. It was before the full scrutiny of all the...
Why is that not still a private agreement?
That's not the commission is not...
These are private parties making an agreement.
That's not what the commission is talking about. They approved it in the public interest with all segments of the industry. They're talking about a private agreement between two parties. That's the distinction they're drawing.
Why do they put paragraph 26 in?
Well, I know, just listening, Your Honor, you have trouble with the term prosecutorial discretion.
Yeah, but unless the commission thought that this was an unlawful agreement, or at least potentially that the omnibus settlement was an unlawful agreement, why bring up prosecutorial discretion?
Because even though this didn't start as a investigation docket, technically, or enforcement, it was to enforce the NGPA price ceilings after this court's decision affirming the commission in 1996, which said refunds had to go back from 19... 19-
Under these circumstances, commission approval of the omnibus settlement was an appropriate exercise of prosecutorial discretion pursuant to the standards discussed in Heckler. Unless they thought there was a prosecutable illegality there or an illegality which could prevent them from enforcing, why bring up Heckler?
The illegality had to do with the refund liability of each individual producer under this court's decision in public service back in 1996. And the commission had to go back to 1983 to determine refund liability. And that's what it was enforcing. It was enforcing the NGPA price ceilings because Kansas ad valorem taxes were found to be unlawful. So that's what it was enforcing. It may not technically have been an enforcement action. And the omnibus settlements resolved that. And the commission determined, even though we can't determine precisely how much, if any, collections an individual producer is retaining in excess of the price, because most of the producers, the larger producers, paid back approximately 75% of their alleged refund liability by the pipeline. Now, would their liability have been 85% or 65% if it had gone through years of litigation? The commission doesn't know. No one knows. In that sense, the commission said, to the extent that maybe after litigation, if the 75%, maybe the producer would have had to pay 80. To that extent, we're using our prosecutorial discretion and letting that producer off the hook. To the extent litigation would have determined that he would have paid 65% rather than the 75% he paid in the settlement, well, that producer got a break. That's what the commission is talking about. Now, the Burlington settlements have nothing to
do. You seem to know more about what the commission is talking about than the commission does, Counselor. They sure didn't tell us any of the things you just told us.
Well, you may recall.
You know, we don't even credit what their counsel says if it isn't backed up by the record, let alone what somebody else comes in and tells us here.
It's not a box to put it in prosecutorial discretion. It seems to transform FERC's role evaluating the settlement agreement into something that, I think the first thing would be to look for whether it was at arm's length and above board in that sense. And then it would be some sort of review to see whether it was an approximation of what parties at the time might have understood to be the way it should come out.
Which is what they did.
But to just say we can choose to profit, we can we're in the heck of a shady category is quite extreme.
The commission is just enforcing the price ceilings, and to save.
Well, it's accepting an agreement, which is a settlement of disputed amounts.
That's exactly right. And if they had the right, as Judge Garland I think asked the question, not to approve it. If they determine that this settlement, even though it would have been agreed to by all parties, including state public utility commissioners, consumers, who are going to get the benefit of this $45 million or $40 million during the heating season at that time, they had the choice to say, no, we want to litigate because maybe we think the producers owe more. They had that option, sure. They're charged with the public interest.
Go back to the hypothetical I gave FERC counsel, the A, B, C, D, only difference being what A, B settle and C, D don't. You want the commission's acceptance in litigation arising long after the fact of the AB settlement to entirely rest on what would be reviewable only for prosecutorial discretion. I think as an actor in the natural gas field, you find that kind of scary.
But which settlement are you talking about here, the omnibus or the
bird? Hypothetical. I was giving you same hypothetical I gave FERC counsel.
Could you repeat that?
Two identical transactions that passed. It's all related to past gas or electricity, okay? But there's a dispute between both sets of parties as to what the actual just and reasonable price ought to have been. One set settles, the other doesn't. And FERC's position, as I understand it, is that after litigating through the parties who persist in the dispute, it is only prosecutorial discretion that prevents the commission from going back and unraveling the AB settlement.
Well, I guess I don't understand that position. I guess if the settlement has been approved and final, it would be done. Just like these omnibus settlements, the producers have paid their amounts under the stated formulas in the settlements.
Suppose there's some delay in the approval of the settlement. Suppose the settlement is agreed at a point where there's uncertainty. Then in the later litigation, the uncertainty is resolved.
Well,
right, with a result that we can.
Well, Your Honor,
actually numerically see exactly how different the settlement price should have been.
Well, you raised that point, I think, much earlier about uncertainty. Well, there's always uncertainty when you settle.
That's why adjudicatory bodies welcome settlements.
If, for example, a producer and a pipeline agreed, we had this, not in this context, but an example, they agreed to an NGPA price of $1. That's what they thought, and a consideration going both ways. But it turned out, for whatever reason, the NGPA category, and that's what's important here, is that these are price ceilings. This remand was sent back to determine the meaning of Section 504, which says it's unlawful to sell gas in excess of the MLP. So if these two parties agree, good faith, arm's length, to $1, but the applicable NGPA category is determined to be, and they had about 25 or 30 categories, was 50 cents. Now the producer could say, just like Burlington, I made a good faith, arm's length transaction here, and I'm being denied I gave valuable consideration, dedicating my reserves from these wells to this pipeline for 20 years. I'm being denied that consideration. I'm being denied the full benefit of my bargain. I can only get 50 cents. Well, that's the essence of regulation. That's the essence of statutory price ceilings. So the fact that he could only collect 50 cents, the contract says a dollar. He has a willing buyer to pay him a dollar for that gas. But it's during the time of the NGPA, and his particular vintage or category only allows 50 cents. He can say, just
settlement.
No, I'm not talking about a settlement. Just, well, settlement's a contract.
Well,
settlement's a contract. A contract's a contract. And consideration goes both ways. It doesn't make any difference if it's a settlement or a contract. It's the same thing. The point is that that particular producer in my example, he gave all the consider. He gave valuable consideration. He's dedicated his gas wells to this pipeline.
Your answer is then that every settlement, viewed in hindsight, involves an implicit price above what is ultimately determined to be the maximum price.
No, not at all. I'm talking about a simple example, price for gas. That's a contract. It doesn't have to be a settlement.
Example, a contract is not relevant.
Right.
We're talking about a settlement under conditions of dispute.
Well, then you could take the, well, I think it is relevant because you're still talking about a contract and consideration that goes both ways. And that's what Burlington has argued here. Whether it's a settlement agreement of disputed contracts or just the initial contract, the point is a producer can say, I have given valuable consideration and I'm not getting the full benefit of my bargain because of the statutory price ceiling.
Okay, if there's no further questions, then your light's been on for a while, too, and I doubt also that you'll mind sitting down.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Petitioner may now be heard again if he wishes to. He's not required to. We'll give you 2 minutes back for rebuttal.
Your Honor, other than if the panel had any further questions, I won't persist.
Okay. I have one question. I'm sorry. In the FERC's order, it suggests that almost all the producers had these take-or-pay agreements with the, what I'm going to use in non-pejorative sense, of boilerplate agreement, and that the consequence is that there'll be no refunds, or virtually none. I noticed in your brief, there was some way to dispute that, although thinking about what you said in your opening argument, you said this was quite typical. Is FERC wrong to be concerned that the consequence of giving effect to the boilerplate agreements is basically that all this litigation about refunds has been totally unnecessary because there were settlements that eliminated them?
I think the FERC is wrong in pointing to that as a reason for refusing to give effect to the Burlington settlements. First of all, I think that the fact is that there were producers, and I think they cited at least a few examples, and I generally would agree that these are usual provisions in these buyout provisions, in these buyout settlements. I think the point is that these agreements were ones that should have been given effect because they were typical and usual, and the fact is that many producers chose not to press this matter. Burlington did. And the fact that other producers failed to protect their rights, I don't think is a reason not to protect Burlington's rights. Further, I think that all those other producers, in fact, have settled, I would think, a second time under the omnibus agreements. So the fact is if you find in Burlington's favor, there is nothing in the omnibus settlements that are going to permit a flood of producers coming in and saying, well, what about our agreement? For better or for worse, they elected not to press their claim. They are that matter under the omnibus settlements, and the omnibus settlements are part of the joint appendix. You can see there's no provision that would allow them to come in now and say, well, if you let Burlington, if you gave effect to Burlington's agreement, you're going to have to give effect to all of ours, and that undoes the omnibus settlement. Like all settlements, the omnibus settlement is a done deal and it should be given effect. And I
know if we hold that they are wrong to have concluded that these settlements in general are unlawful, this will be a new development in the law. And just like there was a new development of the law that led to these other things, like why couldn't they say, well, it's unlawful then? But you don't think they could open up the omnibus one?
I don't think the producers could.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, that would seem to wind up the day's business. Give us a recess.